And this is Kathy returning with the second half of the readings from the Pantograph and the Decatur Tribune for Thursday, the 25th of May. So from Paul Osborne's City Beat, "Thief doesn't know his right foot from his left foot. I walked into Ralph's Shoes downtown the other day. It's the only place I buy my shoes. And while I was there, I told an interesting story. It seems that a thief was in the store recently and made off with a pair of shoes. Apparently, the thief graduated at the bottom of his class in Thiefdom University because the pair of shoes that he grabbed were for the same foot. Imagine his surprise when he put on the shoes and both shoes were for the same foot. I guess he grabbed them from a shoe display and took off. This is the authentic case of some guy not knowing his right foot from his left, or someone who, when it comes to dancing, has two left feet. If you see some guy hopping around with a shoe on one foot, he's probably the thief." Following the shoe caper, I was walking through Central Park, headed for the post office, and the city employee who works hard to keep the park and fountain looking nice approached me and said, "You're not going to believe this." She explained that while she was mowing the grass in the park, and when lunchtime came, she decided to walk over to a bench near the fountain to eat her lunch. When she finished her lunch and went back to continue mowing, the mower was gone. That's right. In broad daylight, someone swiped the city's push mower. She said the mower was just barely out of her line of sight as she was eating her lunch, and the culprit apparently sneaked to the other side of the fountain and then swiped the mower, making sure to keep the fountain between the mower and her so she couldn't see him. And it happened in broad daylight at lunchtime. As I was in the Subway restaurant on North Park Street across from Central Park to pick up a sandwich, a man came in, took a bag of potato chips, and started to leave. "You didn't pay for the chips," the employee behind the counter said to him. "I did earlier with a meal I got here," he yelled back and went on out the door. The employee checked the register and said he didn't buy any meal here, and when I got outside he was long gone. Who steals a small bag of potato chips? So, if you have seen some guy pushing a mower, munching on a bag of potato chips, and walking like a duck because he has two left shoes on his feet, he's probably the serial thief in a downtown public nuisance. I doubt if there are three different brilliant thieves involved in the three incidents above, but it's entirely possible in this day and age. Since I mentioned in the earlier part of this column the City of Decatur employee works hard to keep Central Park and the fountain looking great, she told me what she faces each morning when she comes to work. I won't use her name because she doesn't want the publicity. In order to keep the fountain and the area around it looking nice, she has to clean out vomit, human excrement, and some substances that would probably have to be sent to a lab to determine what they are. Some people use the fountain as a giant bathtub, leaving soap suds everywhere, which can damage the water circulation system of the fountain. She's a hard-working City of Decatur employee, but I'm not sure the specs for her job include such cleanups that are totally unnecessary. "Before I became mayor, I spent 5 years collecting money as matching funds to replace the shell of what had once been the old fountain with its broken lights, electrical system, destroyed bowl, stagnant water, and a few squirts of water that came out. I didn't mind the effort, but it does bother me that a major private public investment in the fountain, transfer house refurbishing, and the park doesn't have better security protect it. I enjoy seeing a lot of people eating their lunch in the park, or sitting on the benches and watching the fountain. That's what it was intended for. Central Park, the transfer house, fountain, and area are meant for the enjoyment of all of our citizens. Like most things in our society today, it only takes a few to ruin it for everybody else. The next time you see a hard-working city employee making the park and fountain look inviting, thank her and any other city employee for their efforts." Macon County Sheriff's Office Lieutenant Jonathan Butts announced Monday evening that he is a candidate for sheriff. Butts made the announcement before a crowd in the adult activity room of the Decatur Public Library. Macon County Sheriff Thomas Schneider announced last month that he will not be running for re-election. Butts is the second candidate coming out of the sheriff's office. Lieutenant Jim Root announced his intention to run for the office last month, and Lieutenant Tony Brown, another member of the sheriff's department, is expected to announce his candidacy soon. Obviously, Butts, Root, and Brown, when he announces, bring decades of experience in the sheriff's office with their candidacies. President Sheriff Schneider is not picking a favorite, but working to help the candidates in their races. The citizens will be well served by the candidate who emerges victorious in this election. And here at the end he says, listen to the City Hall Insider Hour with Paul Osborne on Byers & Company at 7 o'clock every Thursday morning over News Talk 1340 WSOY, or visit our website at DecaturTribune.net and find us on Facebook. This letter to the editor in the Tribune is from Angel Sides. Davis not representing the people of our district. Dear Editor, in the article, Davis, Decatur is an excellent example of a community that works together. Congressman Davis says the new health care bill he voted for does not eliminate insurance for those with pre-existing conditions. In fact, it does give each state the power to eliminate insurance for those with pre-existing conditions. Also, the bill creates a huge tax cut for the wealthy, and it is estimated will cause the deaths of 29,000 Americans due to elimination of coverage. Davis is not representing the people of our district because he has failed to push needed reforms to the ACA, such as the public option. If he truly represented us, he would scrap Obamacare and enact single-payer universal health care like every other civilized nation. We need leaders in Congress to speak out on behalf of all Americans. We have already socialized Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans, etc. When the insurance deductibles are considered single-payer, saves the average household $4,000 a year, and every American is fully covered. I hope it makes sense to the people of Illinois that if you eliminate the middleman, the insurance companies, and the million-dollar salaries of their CEOs, that insurance would be cheaper. When those insurance companies sponsor the media and give campaign contributions to congressmen like Davis, this information is not widely available. Davis does not hold a town hall on this issue or anything because he does not want to answer to his constituents. Despite numerous attempts, I have never been able to talk to Davis face to face, always having to talk to staffers to voice my concern. He was also for the TPP, which even Trump opposes. Rodney Davis is obviously a corporate puppet, and he is selling out to the people of Central Illinois. Angel is from Springfield. And the next editorial, Support Freedom, Oppose Senate Bill 1933. Just recently reported is State Senator Andy Menar accused Governor Rauner of leaking false information about school funding under proposed bill, Senate Bill 1, to the Kankakee Times. Menar said at a press conference, "We're here for a simple reason this morning. It has come to our attention that information that we first saw yesterday in discussions with the governor's office and the Senate Republicans, that false and erroneous drafts of school funding numbers somehow made their way out of a Rauner administration office into the hands of a Bruce Rauner campaign group and are being used for political purposes. But the reality is that the Kankakee Times figures were derived from an analysis of Menar's formula changes performed by the Illinois State Board of Education, also called ISBE. The information has been available on ISBE's website since last summer. A spokesperson for the governor said in a press release, "One cannot leak something that is on public website. Their false and outrageous accusations have been disproven, and they should apologize for manufacturing blatantly false accusations." To the best of my knowledge, the governor and Senate Republicans are still waiting for an apology. Now I see Senator Andy Menar is at it again. He is the chief sponsor of proposed bill, Senate Bill 1933. There is no need for this auto voter registration bill. Why spend more money to implement an unnecessary mandate? It's already easy to register to vote. It's pathetic how Illinois state government has created so much apathy among Illinois citizens that many feel it's a total waste of time to register or vote. Why bother when the Democrat-controlled tax and overspend state government is corrupt? So much so, state government is compelled to intimidate citizens to auto-register to vote. You want a driver's license? Register to vote. If they are allowed to auto-register citizens, I can see it now. Next, the Democratic majority will want to facilitate voting. Voters will have to declare they don't want the state to auto-vote for them, or the state will. And that was written by Roger German from Decatur. Also from the Tribune, City Council approves vehicle purchases. The Decatur City Council on Monday approved the purchase of 5 vehicles for the city's Public Works Department. Purchases totaling more, $136,423, made with Decatur's Jackson Ford as the newest responsible bidder. The purchased vehicles include 1 2017 Ford F-150 and 4 2017 Ford F-250s to be allocated to the Public Works Department Street, Sewers, and Water Services Division, and the vehicles will replace existing cars that are past their normal life expectancy or in poor condition. The city's recently announced reorganization is expected to help extend the life of both the new and some of the existing vehicles because the original divisions of Public Works and the recently added Water Services and Water Production divisions can now more closely coordinate vehicle usage. And now turning back to the Herald and Review, let's take a look at the obituaries for today. The first one, Doty Richard Earl from Decatur. Richard Earl Doty, 53 of Decatur, passed away Monday, May 22nd at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. Services to celebrate Rick's life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, May 26th at Moran and Goble Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the services at the funeral home. Burial with military honors will be in the Friends Creek Cemetery in Argenta. Memorials are suggested to the American Heart Association. Richards, Florence B., from Effingham. Florence B. Richards, 93, of Effingham, passed away at 3:19 a.m. on Tuesday, May 23rd at HSHS St. Anthony's Memorial Hospital in Effingham. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, May 29th at Johnson Funeral Home, 1110 North 4th Street in Effingham. Burial will be in Beecher City Cemetery in Beecher City. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until the time of service on Monday at the funeral home. Memorials may be made in loving memory of Florence to the HSHS St. Anthony's Memorial Hospital Auxiliary on Maple Street in Effingham or the Beecher City Cemetery. Online condolences may be shared at johnsonandsonfh.com. And the next one, Weinman, John C. from Decatur. John C. Weinman, 77, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, May 21st at the Decatur Memorial Hospital, surrounded by his family. Funeral services to celebrate the life of John C. Weinman will be at 2 p.m. Sunday, May 28th at Moran and Goble Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Sunday before the service at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Children's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri, or Haven House in Crèvecœur, Missouri. Swayze, from Decatur, John C. Swayze, 90, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away Sunday, May 21st, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur, Illinois. Cremation rites will be accorded. Graveside services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 27th, at Bethel Cemetery in Blue Mound, Illinois. Brittlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Decatur will be handling the arrangements. Memorials may be made to Decatur Gem and Mineral Club. Reynolds, from Iliopolis. Frankie A. Reynolds, 84, of Iliopolis, passed away on Sunday, May 21st at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. until the time of the service at 1 p.m. on Friday, May 26th at Iliopolis Christian Church, with Reverend Melissa Ebkin officiating. Burial will follow at the Riverside Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the Iliopolis Christian Church. Johnson, from Brownstown. Helen E. Johnson, 100, of Brownstown, died at 3:20 p.m. Monday, May 22nd at Fayette County Hospital in Vandalia. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, May 26th at the Geese King Claggett Funeral Home in Brownstown, with Pastor Larry Clonch officiating. Burial will follow at Liberty Cemetery in rural Brownstown. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to service town. Memorials may be made to the Liberty Christian Church, Brownstown, or the Seventh-day Adventist Church in St. Elmo. Weatherford, from Decatur. Lillian Weatherford, Miss Lil, 74, of Decatur, passed away on Tuesday, May 23rd, in her home. Honoring Lillian's wishes, she will be cremated. And those are the only obituaries we have for today. Turning to arts and entertainment, sensory-friendly performances now at the Little Theater by Danette Beckett from Sullivan. As the Associate Artistic Director for the Little Theater on the Square, Therese Kincaid aims to create plays that everyone can enjoy. She knows that many children and some adults find live theater to be a stressful or frightening experience. Many parents don't bring kids to the theater because they get scared or may disturb someone or shout out, she said. To address this dilemma, the theater has introduced sensory-friendly performances during the summer children's shows. One performance for each of the three plays will be altered for guests who have sensitivity issues, such as those with disorders on the autism spectrum and small children. The changes will be minimal, Kincaid said. Most kids will not know the difference. Sensory-friendly performances include a well-lit auditorium throughout the show, lower volume and no loud or sudden sounds, no cast entrances or exits through the auditorium, and the cast will introduce themselves before the show. Children will not be required to stay seated or quiet. A limited number of assisted listening devices are available at the ticket office. This opens the door for experiencing the theater for the first time, said John Stevens, executive director. It can be a teaching tool for parents as well. A quiet space is available a short distance from the auditorium for families in case a child should get overwhelmed and need to leave for a short break. Theater staff have maintained one popular aspect of the children's shows, the post-show and meet-and-greet. The kids still love the autograph session, Kincaid said. The staff believes that the special shows would be ideal for young children who are sometimes overwhelmed by strangers, dark rooms, and loud noises. If you want to bring your 4-year-old, but you know it might be too much for them, you could come to these shows, Kincaid said. There are all sorts of people with sensory issues. It's not just people on the autism spectrum. As a special education teacher in Sullivan for 27 years, Christine Groller works with children with special needs, including those with Down syndrome or on the autism spectrum. When she has taken her students to the theater for summer children's shows, they are often startled by surprises during the performances. But we've adapted, she said. In the past, one of the accommodations Groller has made is to simply warn the children what is to come. She said she thinks the sensory-friendly performances will make the field trips easier. Letting the kids meet the characters, that's a great idea, she said. The directors said they understand sensory-friendly performances are not a one-size-fits-all solution. They know the shows will need to be adjusted as they learn what works and what doesn't. We still want to be as inclusive as we can, Stevens said. International Arts Experience exhibit focuses on China by Danette Beckett from Decatur. The Madden Art Center will be filled with Chinese cultural artifacts during the annual International Arts Experience throughout June until July 27th. The exhibit, China, Symbols and Motifs, A Chinese Art Journey, will feature contemporary and traditional pieces, providing a taste of the rich history and culture of China. It will be displayed in the Ann Lloyd Gallery. Sue Powell, Gallery Director for Decatur Area Arts Council, collaborated with Dr. Ian Wang, Director of the United States China Cultural Exchange Association in Rantoul. Wang is also the curator of the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois. He has been a collector of Chinese art for most of his life, has an amazing private collection, and is an aficionado on Chinese art too, Powell said. About half of the exhibit is from Wang's collection, with the remaining pieces from other sources, including Millikan University's Burks Museum, Gertz Education Center, at the University of Illinois' Krannert Art Center, and local individuals. More than 60 pieces are from Wang's collection, including traditional paintings, jade carvings, porcelain and ceramics, tea sets, and vases. Special to his collection is a group of paintings referred to as heavy color paintings. The modern paintings were created by artists from Wang's hometown of Kunming, the capital of Yunnan, a province of southwest China. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, modern or abstract art was not encouraged in his homeland, he said. It was not mainstream, Wang said. In late 70s, the artists wanted more freedom. The art was created using colorful shapes and forms. This style was introduced into the United States in the 1980s, where it gained popularity. Along with the artwork, the exhibit will feature historical pieces of calligraphy, furniture, lanterns, tea sets, and baskets. Wang will offer a special artist talk from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, June 7th, at the Ann Lloyd Gallery. Although he will be visiting the exhibit during the First Friday Gallery Walk on June 2nd, he has allowed other cultural activities to be highlighted during the monthly event. The third floor of the Madden Art Center will feature performances of traditional Chinese music and folk dances, as well as martial arts demonstrations. Visitors will have the opportunity to taste authentic Chinese cuisine. The second floor will have Chinese art demonstrations and calligraphy lessons. Other June art exhibits at the Bicentennial Art Center. Beginning June 16th, the Paris Art Center will display the exhibit Father's Day, A Homecoming, until July 14th. An opening reception will be from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Friday, June 16th. The Blue Connection. Millikan University's retail art facility will feature the work of Millikan University art student and Robert Crowder artist-in-residence Madison Ciaccio. The Decatur Airport Gallery. The artwork of Annette Russo will be displayed at the Airport Gallery throughout June. Flourishes Gallery and Studios. The Downtown Shelbyville Gallery will exhibit Belongings, featuring the oil paintings of Ben Cohan, for the birds. A collection of birdhouses by Aaron Cole will be in Studio D. The main hall of the gallery will feature the still life paintings of Carol Kessler. The displays will be featured until July 15th. Gallery 510 will feature the artwork of the gallery's executive director, Jamie Rutherford, titled Threadbare, with a focus on mental health, emotional challenges, and healing. A reception will be held during First Friday Gallery Walk, 5 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday, June the 2nd. An artist's talk will be at 6:30 p.m. The Gertz Gallery. Beginning June 19th, the Parkland College Gallery will feature the exhibit Around the Block 2, Artists from Our Neighborhood, until August 9th. A reception will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, June 22nd, with an artist talk at 6 p.m. by Lisa Costello, Kelly White, and juror Giselle Atterbury. Closing reception will be at 6 p.m. August 9th, with a gallery talk by Atterbury. At the Krannert Art Museum, the University of Illinois Art Museum will display on the main level of the Contemporary Gallery the exhibit Land Grant. University students collected pieces from libraries, archives, and collections, focusing on the history of the U of I and its layout. The display will be open until July 8th. The West Gallery of the main level will exhibit Dynamic Structures, American Abstract Artists. The exhibit in rehearsal features the work of Autumn Knight. The display will be open until July 8th. At the Lincoln Art Institute, beginning June 8th, it will display the exhibit inspired by at the Lincoln Art Institute on McLean Street. The Rock Springs Nature Center, the North Wing Art Gallery, will display the scenic photography of Chris and Alan Perry. The nature photography of Katina Williams will be featured in the South Gallery, and both exhibits will be on display until the end of June. Illinois State University Art Gallery will feature the artwork from adults with disabilities during Mark Making Artists of Mark First. Also at the gallery will be the exhibit of lighted sculptures by Dennis French. The Upstairs Gallery, the artwork of Sue Watts, will be displayed at the Decatur Public Library Second Floor Gallery throughout June. And Wildflower Artisan Bakery and Cafe will have the artwork of Barbara Dove featured at the Artisan Cafe throughout the month. And an article from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Phillips, How Star Wars Blazed a Path for Filmmakers Across the Galaxy. It doesn't seem capitalistically feasible to imagine a world without Star Wars in it, selling us stuff like the now-faded Star Wars pillowcase in one of the upstairs bedrooms, or the long-broken lightsabers littering the nether regions of the basement closet. But there was a time before a long time ago. This was prior to 1977 B.C., which means before Chewbacca. George Lucas, hot off his semi-autobiographical 1973 nostalgia reverie American Graffiti, was struggling with a script called Adventures of the Starkiller, featuring a swashbuckling accessory known in early drafts as a laser sword with a Z. The new old word combo lightsaber sounded better, I think we can agree. That script adjustment was one stroke of luck among thousands that made Star Wars blow up like a Death Star. The summer before Star Wars opened, if you were 15, disclosure, I was, and you wanted to see something with ray guns, disclosure, I did, you saw Logan's Run. The 1976 release was shot, in part, inside a newfangled suburban Dallas mall, the spaciest-looking retail emporium around. It took place in the 23rd century and starred Michael York as the law enforcement Sandman, a member of a hermetically sealed society built on hedonistic pleasure, but also on the ritual of killing off all citizens at the age of 30. Unlike Star Wars, this was pretty racy for a PG-rated picture, which I didn't mind. I saw Logan's Run twice. Back then, if I thought a movie was just okay, I went twice. If I liked a movie, I saw it three or four times. I saw Star Wars four times. This meant I was something of an outlier regarding the movie that changed everything. But back to Logan's Run for a minute, because Logan's Run helps explain the success of Star Wars. A medium hit in its day, Logan's Run was the latest in a long, increasingly wearying line of late 1960s-70s dystopian diversions. among them the Charlton Heston Savior allegory Planet of the Apes, the Omega Man, and Soylent Green. In that decade, in a futuristic fantasy ended with one man, a man always, the women were incidental and primarily decorative, fighting back against a hopeless totalitarian mess in a world suffering from air quality that comes from U.S. presidents who weaken the Environmental Protection Agency for fun and profit. Then I was a satisfied customer. Happy enough endings were to be expected in a commercial movie-going era marked by astonishing freedom as well as free-floating lyrical disillusionment. Then Star Wars came along. Plenty of calculation, but no cynicism, no dread, no dystopia. Writer-director Lucas wanted to do an update on the Flash Gordon serials he saw on TV in Modesto, California as a kid. The sole TV channel in Lucas's preteen life, KRON-TV, showed Flash Gordon every night. The rights, as controlled by King Features, were too pricey, according to Lucas's partner Gary Kurtz. They wanted too much money, too much control, so starting over and creating from scratch was the answer, Kurtz told Los Angeles Times writer Jeff Butcher. The result came entirely from other movies. Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress provided the narrative inspiration. Errol Flynn's swashbucklers such as the Seahawk sparked Lucas's notion to use lightsabers. As ambivalent as I am about the merchandising impulse behind Lucas's empire, now in the hands of Disney, and as queasy as I sometimes feel about a Toy Story influence of Star Wars in our popular culture, the lightsabers are cool. Our basement may be littered with toy lightsabers of varying sizes, no longer functional, but there's a metaphor about childhood buzzing around in there somewhere. Age never had anything to do with Star Wars. 40 years ago and today, the movie worked as Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers' nostalgia for parents and grandparents. Their kids and grandkids experience the same movie, not as a savvy amalgam of spare movie parts, but as brand new, hopped-up proto-video game in a 2-hour, 1-minute movie form. The second film, The Empire Strikes Back, was a little rougher, a little more inventive and expansive, made, tellingly, by director Irvin Kershner, not George Lucas. Lucas went on to sour millions on Star Wars with his antiseptic self-directed prequel trilogy, the movies that came after the initial three. Watching Lucas's American Graffiti again the other day, it came as a beautiful surprise how fluid and right the direction of that picture was and is. Lucas never made another movie like it, or another remotely as good. It meant a lot to me when I was 12. In its arrested adolescent male remembrance of anxiety's past, it opened a window. Star Wars didn't open a window. It was, for some of us, simply a good time. The movie some of us went nuts for came a few months later. Lucas and Steven Spielberg were pals and colleagues, and are still. When Lucas was sweating through Star Wars post-production, wonder if he'd ever get the special effects to look special, Spielberg was working through the same ordeal on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. As recounted in Joseph McBride's definitive Spielberg biography, Lucas screened a Star Wars rough cut, minus the John Williams music and the effects, for a few friends, and the 20th Century Fox executives, nervous about their investment. Lucas's then-wife, Marcia, burst into tears when the lights came up and privately called it a long-last love of sci-fi, referring to Peter Bogdanovich's notorious 1975 musical flop. Spielberg said he liked it and predicted a big hit, though privately he stewed about the Star Wars beating Close Encounters to theaters by a few crucial months. As it happened, both movies found their audience, the same audience, really, though the last 30 minutes of Close Encounters reached for the sublime and captured it, whereas Star Wars may do with a hyperspace jump, a nifty effect for the time. Close Encounters was an enormous success, and as director Jean Renoir put it to his friend François Truffaut, who appeared in Spielberg's film, "There is more than a grain of eccentricity in this adventure. The author is a poet." Star Wars, Lucas said back in 1975, 2 summers before its release, is built on top of many things that came before. Would it have been the same phenomenon if Lucas had gotten the rights to remake Flash Gordon? If he had, today would the 7-year-old in our house be hanging on to his Flash Gordon pillowcase, the one in its last threads? No, as Yoda would say, we never will. And that's all we have time for today. You have a great weekend. This is Kathy signing off with the Herald and Review and the Decatur Tribune for Friday, the 25th of May.